So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Looks like I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in
me. Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm out. Greg Pappas on the board and in studio. S&P futures up 3, NASDAQ futures down 3. This is after a pretty bad day yesterday in the market. We started kind of the upside yesterday morning. Matter of fact, we were the upside, and then we did the U-turn, as they used to say on the trading floor. We ended up down 62 in the S&P and 290 in the NASDAQ. Ouch, it's almost 1.8%. Carl, do you know where your short futures are?
Well, you know, I tell you, there's this wee little problem in the data. And I've been talking about it for a while. Nobody wants to hear it.
Nobody
wants to hear it. There's rates are absolutely going to go down. But no, they're not.
Well, the 10-year was up like 100 basis points a day, it seems.
Well, no, 100 basis points a day would be, I mean, you know, that's 1%.
Goes, I mean, I'm sorry, 10 basis points. We went from 4.5 to 4.6 yesterday, and we went from 4.4 to 4.5 on Friday. I mean, it's 10 basis points, you are correct.
Well, why is anybody surprised by that?
I don't know, but they seem stunned.
Well, I don't know. You know, I guess that's the thing that I have kind of a problem with the way people are looking at this, is that they're really, you shouldn't be surprised by any of this. And, you know, as I've pointed out for quite some time, the curve inversion that we've had has been ridiculously extreme. Okay, I mean, when you've got a 13-week bill, you know, that's trading 5.2-ish, and you got a 10-year note that's trading 4.4-ish, okay? And by the way, a couple weeks ago it was trading 4.2-ish,
yeah,
right? What is that telling you? Well, it tells you that time has negative value. That's what it says.
Well, it could be telling you that people are assuming, you know, if the numbers reflect actually people's attitude, it would be telling you that we have a 3% inflation rate now, and it's going to drop to 1.5% over the next 10 years. That's what it could be telling you. That's what it should be telling you. I don't know if that's what it's telling you. Let's put it that way.
No, Chief. 3%, 2% inflation, and 3% productivity growth, which is the historical average over the last 100 years, is a zero time value rate of 5.
Okay.
Have you ever known time to not have? Would you? How much would you pay to have 20 years back?
Depends on which 20.
You're older than I am, although not by a lot. Okay. If I could wind the clock back from 60 to 40.
Yeah, everybody do that.
Yeah, we'd pay for that, right?
Oh yeah.
That's yeah. Of course, none of us actually can.
Well, you don't want to wind the knowledge back. You want to wind the body
right,
back.
I get that. Okay, yeah. But point being, anybody that believes that the structure, that the rate structure we have today, is actually forecasting anything other than more bubble mania, is out of their blinkety 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 mind.
Well,
all right.
You know, take this with somewhat of a grain of salt, okay? Because you're just a little younger than me, but there's like a how can I put this without sounding like a moron? What the hell? But I'll sound like a moron. There's a key. Let's say I'm 5 years older. I don't know what the number is, but say I'm 5 years older. Think of it as, Carl, that it was a very key 5 years in the sense that when I started, the absolute mirror image of what you're seeing right now. Absolute mirror image. And when you saw the rates that were available short term, now this is an explosion of what today is. That's what I'm saying. It could be this, because it was then. Your short-term rates were 15, all right? And
yeah.
Your long-term rates on a 30-year were like 12. So they got to maybe 12, 12 and a half.
Right.
And so the difference between the two was inflation was out of control, and everybody felt that over the next 10 to 30 years, somehow it would come under control. So if you valued your interest rates going forward by a normal model, say 2.5 plus inflation or 3 plus inflation, you would see the tail end of that, the inflation rate going down. So you had the negatively sloping curve just like you do now, but that was the reason. Nobody thought that we were going to have a 12% inflation 10 years down the line, that somebody somewhere would fix the damn thing, you know, and get it under control. And sure enough, somebody did, or somebody's did. I think there's a little of that kind of right now, but the thing that I tried to explain last week, and I don't know, I probably explained it 10 times, and I don't think I did it right once, there is such a momentum. I mean, if I could spirit you back, not 5 years or 20 years, but I would spirit you back to the trading floor in 1981, you had people who never touched the stock since 1968, 69. It was the same price 13 years later.
Right, I know.
And everybody, the mentality was such that it could never change. There were people, I mean, hell, like I said, there were people who had been, options exchange opened at 73, never saw a bull market. Well, a couple times it ran up somewhere in there and ran back down. Never saw anything like it. It was how much short stack you could get off, how much short stack interest you could get, how many times you could do the reversal, which is short stack, short put, long call, more than anybody needs to know. That was the game. There were people who paid for reversals and got a check every month of like $100,000 in interest. I mean, the mentality then was such that it was never going to change. This was our productive life. I mean, if you entered a business in 68 and it's now 82, you're 35. You've never seen anything else. And even when it was obvious to me starting out, God, this is going to change and change pretty soon, it wasn't pretty soon. It was 18 months after I got into the business before we had the first big rally. And all of a sudden, rates started to come down, and basically we haven't looked back yet. I mean,
right. Well, that's, yeah. And the thing is that that's the other side of it.
Okay, but now, let me quick finish, sorry. Now it's 2007, and the young Carl fires into the trading scene. And you know what? Or 2008. If you haven't been along that whole way, which, you know, I've been protected the whole way. For 97 to 2007, we were the stars of the world. Now, anybody who was protected since 2007, since 2007 has been, what'd you buy auto insurance for? We had this new system you can't crack up. You know, and now all of a sudden, now that tone is changing, you know, somewhat. But Carl, 14 years, 15 years is a long time. When you enter the business at 21 and it's 35, you never saw anything else.
Oh no, and that was exactly the point I was about to make. Is that you have, you know, I know a couple of people that are much younger than I am, and you know, and got into the finance business, working for, you know, what used to be the Big Five, not so much anymore, right? I mean,
yep.
After 08, And they've never known, literally never known, from infancy, you know, from the point that they were sentient enough to know what money was, they've never known a market where you actually had to pay for time, where time actually had value. And they don't see it that way. They don't even conceptualize the time value of interest rates. That's part of the calculation. It's just not the way that they're.
Well, it is if you got a credit card, bud.
Well, I get that, but it's not how they're wired.
No.
Okay, because in the financial, you know, in the finance world, okay, leave aside, you know, the 27% credit card, right? It's a prime one to begin with. You know, and it's even better if your credit score stinks, right?
Yep.
By the way, I think I mentioned this on Friday. There is something funny going on. The FICO guys have sniffed this out. They've sniffed out trouble, and they did this back in 07 and the early part of 08 as well. It was a pattern that I noted at the time and made a lot of noise about. Everybody said I was a nut, that I must have done something, you know, that there's some change in my life pattern or what I do that was picked up by the algorithms, blah, 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 blah. No, I don't think so. I mean, since I sold my internet company, my way of living has been quite stable. The amount of money I spend every month has been quite stable. Where I spend it has been quite stable. And I run essentially everything in my household through plastic because I want my 1% or 2% back or whatever have you. But it gets paid off every single month. Okay, I have not carried a balance even once in like 30 years. Okay, so hey, I take advantage of this. If Amex wants to give me 2% back on groceries, I'm gonna put all my groceries on my Amex card. Okay, and come the end of the month, I pay it off.
Well, you would surely think that that you would get the 2% discount for cash, not the other way around.
Well, if you gave me a 2% discount for cash, I'd be walking around with a stack of Benjamins in my wallet.
Well, that's okay? What I'm saying. You wonder why the it goes the other way. I think I might discover.
Well, you know what? No, I know what it is, and I understand. I understand the reason they do this, okay? And you know, you my daughter is much younger, doesn't have a stable asset base that she lives on, you know, like I do and things like this. She actually has to work to make money to to pay for the normal things of life. And when she first came of age, had a credit union account, you know, they offer her, okay, you know, we'll give you MasterCard. And I warned her, I said, whatever you do, do not accumulate a balance. I said, if you want to ruin your financial life, that's how you do it.
Well, that means you got to tell her, don't ever sprain your ankle, don't ever.
Well, she's had to do it a couple of times, right? I mean, you know, she had a serious car problem when she was traveling, and you know, like it or not, right? But here's the thing. I told her, you know, as a routine basis, do not ever use this thing as a cash management tool to cross over months and things like this. It's a mistake, and you're going to pay for it. Figure out how to be within your means. If something terrible happens, well, you know, life's tough, and then there you go. Within months, all right, now this is somebody who's just turned 18. Within months, they start jacking up the allowable amount of credit, all right? And, of course, she runs it up a little bit. She pays it off. She runs it up a little bit. She pays it off. She runs it up a little bit. And FICO starts going up, you know, from not having anything, right? Scores going up. Available line starts going up. Next thing you know, she's getting every pre-solicited offer in the mail you can dream of.
Oh, God, yeah. It's overwhelming. I probably get five a week.
And I've helped her to sift that because she didn't want, you know, I think everybody should have at least two, okay? Why? Because things happen, banks merge, policies change, whatever, and getting caught with your pants down is a bad thing, especially if you're traveling somewhere when it happens. And so, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, fine. Well, she's settled on a couple, and that's perfectly okay. But then again, as time has gone on, her earnings power has gone up. She's made more money. You know, her job skills improve. You know, it's like everybody else, right? I mean, that's what happens. It's what happened with me. You know, when I was a schlub doing programming, I wasn't all that good at it when I first started. Good at it now, but I wasn't that good. I still got paid to do that kind of job, but then I got paid more. Okay, fine. Point being, my situation has been very stable for a very long time, and in 07, 08, all of a sudden, out of the middle of nowhere, 20 points disappear off my FICO after having not moved for 10 years.
Is that, which, is it the same, you sure the person giving you the FICO is using the same rating agency?
Yes, because
there's what, three
Discover,
of them?
Because Discover gives it to you every month at no charge as part of your deal.
Right, I get. How is Discover giving us a 5% discount on gas this quarter? How do they get that out of the station?
Well, it's so the entire game among these cards is to get you to run. They are not stupid. They know that 5% is tiny compared to the 25% they get to charge you if you run a balance. Okay, so the entire gambit is to keep you on the edge of insolvency, to run that card up where you're not going to be able to pay it off at the end of the month. And that's the reason they do this. And they entice you with these things, because the more stuff you put on there, you know, let's face it, it's the same reason they use chips in a casino. The reason you don't use money in a casino is if I look at the $100 bill I put on the table, I might not put it on the table.
Right. Oh yeah.
Okay. It's just a chip. It's just a chip. It's just a card. It's just a card.
Yeah, but the black chip is a Benjamin.
Well, I get that, but they, you know, but that's the mentality, right? And it's the same game here. But back in late 07 and early 08, I saw the same pattern. All of a sudden, no change in what I do, where I go, you know, my lifestyle, whatever have you. All of a sudden, out of the middle of nowhere. Now, to me, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, you know, hey, listen, when you're in the rarefied air up there, you know, 20 points doesn't mean anything. The guy
there's no difference between an 811 and 791, really.
Zero.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, it literally doesn't mean anything. All right. However, for the guy that's a 650, that 20 points is the difference between being able to get a credit card or get a
car. Or get a mortgage or anything, yeah.
Or a mortgage.
Or an apartment now. An apartment now.
Right. Well, and getting turned down. Okay, and that's what I'm seeing. It's happening again now. You know, a month does not a pattern make. We'll see whether or not this was a glitch in the matrix, and you know, I crossed a line somewhere because I was traveling and you know ran $300 in gas that you know because I was dragging my trailer all over the country. You know, whatever. I don't know. We'll see, but I don't think so. And because it just, you know, didn't make any sense in terms of like, well, you know, I bought a whole bunch of stuff for blah, or, you know, I just charged up a whole crap ton of money because I needed to have something fixed in the house, and then I was going to pay it off at the end of the month, but, you know, but I happened to cross at the time that they looked at it with, you know, with 15 grand at the card, right, or something like this. But that didn't happen. So I think the probability is that this has been sussed out. I have said all along that from the pattern I see here, we're not going to get through the year without a very large correction coming. Maybe something people will call a crash. And the length and the duration and depth of the inversion that I've seen in the curve here, this is literally in, I mean, you're in 1970s land here.
Well, you've got everybody, this few days we've been going down now the last week, and where we got the Dow's almost even on the year, right, or something, after the last few days. But if you listen to the pundits after the close, it's you'll never see a buying opportunity like this again. Anybody who doesn't buy NVIDIA at 862 is an absolute moron. It's all you hear.
Oh, I know. I mean, every now and then I turn this on, and the pukes that are on, you know, CNBC just, you know, oh, good God. Don't do it while you have something in your mouth. But, I mean, This pattern, the underlying pattern, normally when you see this kind of a thing in the yield curve, within you know 6 months or so, you see it show up in the employment numbers. You see it up in the you know showing up in the retail sales figures and things like this. But where it has also been showing up is in the regional Fed indices. And that's it. You don't get away with that one. That showed up in the 07 time frame and early 08 as well. And it's there in the New York and Philly Fed indices as well.
Yeah.
And those that data is really soft.
Well, we started talking about, because I want to ask you a little bit about the some of the war stuff, but the thing that's kind of in the whole group, you mentioned that the mindset just isn't there. If I got up in front of a class, and I haven't taught in a while, but I mean, if there was a class of 30 people here talking about the market, and I were to say, you know, just put the capital asset pricing model up on the page, which is the simplest thing on earth. If you were to say to somebody, you know, we've got a long-term, 10-year rate of, say, 4%. And if I were to say, well, you know, if we know perfectly what every company is going to do, what the market's going to do, like if you just bought the index or something, we know perfectly what the returns are going to be for the next 10 years. And yet I just change this interest rate number from 4 to, say, 5.5. You do realize that if all else being equal, the price of the market is now just dropped by 20%.
Right.
They'd look at me like I had 15 heads, and I had, you know, and they'd wonder who the hell I was. They have no idea what I was talking about.
Oh, well, yeah, and the other problem is that the implied leverage in the equity market is it's probably 4 or 5 times what it was 10 years
ago. Oh, yeah.
And that is a serious problem in terms of price if rates go up. I mean, now, you know, not tomorrow, not in a day, because, you know, there's time involved in all the financing that's out within the corporate sector. You know, commercial paper rolls really fast. But the longer tenor stuff, what's the average tenor among all that paper out there? Probably, you know, 5 to 7 years or something like that. Probably not a whole lot different than a mortgage,
right,
in terms of the actual duration.
If the rates go high enough, I mean, I can remember, Carl, in 1981, if I were to say to you, Carl, I'm giving you $100,000, but oh, by the way, you don't get it for 7 years, you'd almost say, don't bother. Because the discounted price at 15% was what? You know, 10?
Well, yeah. 12, I mean, well, exactly, Chief, but that is the problem, right? I mean, within the market structure we have today is that everybody thinks that that is just, you know, no, that's not going to happen. This company has, you know, $50 billion worth of, worth of paper out. By the way, the average weighted maturity on that is, you know, is 2 years from now. And it's going to start rolling this year. And they don't got that much money laying around to pay it off. They're going to have to roll it. They have no choice. Well, when they roll it, what's that going to do to their operating margin?
Maybe they wish they wouldn't have bought all the stock back at 10% higher prices.
Well, you know, maybe they would wish they didn't, but you know what? You can't, again, you can't turn the clock back, can you?
No, but you'll never hear that out of me. You know, I got somewhat of a war question, and it's not about tactics or anything like that, but on Saturday I was, you know, listening to TV, and I forget what station it was. It might have been Fox, but they brought this retired general on, this very well-spoken, this African-American dude. God, was he smart. And he started talking about, he goes, you know, I don't understand what they're doing with this. He goes, it wasn't very successful. You had to fly over a whole bunch of other people's countries. You ended up, you had public opinion worldwide kind of helping out the people who don't like Israel, because they've gone all overboard by just about anybody's estimation in Gaza. And you've got demonstrations everywhere. Now, the guys from Iran do this, and the thing is a total, like, a fiasco on their part. But it costs a lot of money to knock all this stuff down. You know, I actually looked, Carl, the closest point between Iran and Israel is 1,300 miles.
Yeah.
So you got to go over other people. He goes, something else is going on here. This has to be some kind of a diversion, or it's done with, he didn't say, a bunch of old stuff just to cause people to spend a lot of new stuff to get rid of it or something. Because this is clearly, they couldn't possibly have expected this thing to do anything other than
Chief, it gets more stupid than that. There's plenty of rumor flying around that it's probably true that that both Israel knew that it was coming.
Well, yeah, you can tell, say, your watch buy it from last week. The market was going up, too, or mix was going up.
And oil.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, there are also rumors out there that the United States not only was aware of it, but approved it.
Iran coming after Israel?
Yeah.
We
because, had, well, you know, but
we're the ones who shot down 80 of their stuff. We're 80, 80 well, whatever yeah, we well, use yeah. down.
But, you know, Chief, here's the basic bottom line on all this kind of stuff that I always tell people. Look, if I really intend to ruin your day, right, whether I'm going to carjack you, I'm going to rip off your house, you know, stick a gun in your face and give me all your money, you know, whatever, right? If I really, or when it comes to, you know, nation states doing those kinds of things, you never threaten to do anything. You just do it. You don't get the element of surprise is worth, you know, 5-to-1 numerical superiority.
Well, we're also
so what is this? What is this? I'm gonna hit you. I'm gonna hit you. I'm gonna hit you. I'm gonna hit you. Oh, that's very nice. Let me move a carrier group over here. Get a bunch of planes and AWACS up in the air. Let's make sure that all of our missiles are, you know, are primed. The power supplies are all powered up. Everything's working. We don't want to have a situation where all of a sudden that Patriot battery, the power trailer that, you know, that provides the electricity for it, something, you know, you push the button to start that thing and it doesn't turn on, right? No, we can't have that. So since you gave us all this nice warning, let's make sure that, and by the way, let's make sure all of our guys are staring at the scope all the time.
Well, how many drones are there that can go 1,300 miles with any kind of a payload?
Well, that's the other thing that goes with this. One of the things that says this is too cute by half is that if I build a bunch of what the Germans had in World War II, you know, the V1s, right? Not very accurate, not very fast. You know, pulse jet engine, loud as hell, so you knew they were coming.
Yeah.
You know, really, if you can actually get a gun on them, not very hard to shoot. So, you know, they made a lot of noise and they struck a lot of terror into the, you know, into Londoners, but they didn't do a whole lot of damage because not a whole lot
of
them
got. Well, it's like a Scud missile, but if it landed on your head, it did damage.
Well, right. If it landed on you, it was bad. But a Scud missile actually, you know, has some speed and stuff. You know, and a drone really kind of sort of don't, right? However, if I can fire is not really the right word, launch a $20,000 drone at you, and you spend a $10 million missile on it.
Well, that's a problem. Well, that was going to be my question. When you look at these people that are doing this, and I say these people, the players that are in power, you got Iran with, you know, Fari and all the other people I know from Iran say 90% of the people want those guys out of there. We're going to have to dash here in a second, Carol, but because we'll pick this up Friday. The money supply is up like 30% a year in Iran. Everything is screwed. I don't know how you even pay the guys. Their currency's down against the dollar, what, like 15% in the last month. I mean, I don't know how you even pay the guys if you want to buy. Are they that incompetent that they have no idea what they're doing? It seems like the Putin's sort of the same way, but he didn't care if he gets rid of all his own people. Is it people?
Well, except here's the difference. Putin, Putin may be the same way, but Putin really isn't the same way. You take a look at that. Right. You know, we were going to ruin them with sanctions. How'd that work out?
Well, that's right. But I'm saying some of these people, are they just that incompetent, or is there some, you know, meeting somewhere that we all missed of the five no goodniks in the world, Iran, South Korea, or North Korea, and those people just doing all this kind of random stuff just to break us money wise, kind of the maybe let's kick that one up on Fridays. You know, the anti-Ronald, the flip Ronald Reagan deal, where okay, the U.S. looked pretty good in this deal, but by the way, it cost us $50 million that we don't have, or $150 million, or whatever the hell it is.
I mean, that there might be something to that.
You know, I just wonder. Hey, Friday should be an interesting show. Hey, we got a bunch of stuff. Let's just hope we're not in the middle of a war by Friday. We can analyze rather than duck, shall we say?
There you go.
What do you say we go right to our Aaron and Greg? Aaron, you with us?
He left.
He left.
Yeah.
Well, Carl's
it's okay. We'll go to break, and
If he doesn't come back, hopefully Carl'll still be around.
Yeah.
SP Futures up. Around.
SP Futures up 9. NASDAQ Futures up 19. We're trying to get up here this morning, just like we were yesterday. Maybe today we'll actually make it. Be right back, Stacks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to gauge the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other decision. And Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with relevant trade ideas, and equips you with cutting-edge tactics you don't already know. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on pursuing life, luxury, and happiness through sports, fitness, travel, food, spirits, music, and a whole lot more. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, welcome back, Stacks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. Let's do this real quick, Greg, because we have Aaron waiting. SP Futures up 9 now. NASDAQ Futures up 19. We just turned positive. I'll just do some bonds here. Bonds are up 2 basis points to 4.65, so they're not coming down, at least not yet. Blend up 3 basis points, 2.46. Japan up 2.88. We've got oil. That's important enough. Oil's down 34 cents, but still 85.07. We've got gold, which was down yesterday and turned around, came back up. It's up 410, 2387. Kind of still, it was over 2400 for a little bit. Why don't you give us a real quick traffic, weather, sports, and then we'll get to Aaron.
All right. Morning, everyone. 636 here in Chicago, 52 degrees right now. Cloudy, rain late afternoon today. High of 60 here. Phoenix, 57 right now. Warmer, plenty of sunshine later. High of 87 there. Inbound Kennedy, 20 minutes from Montrose. Edens, 43 minutes from Lake Cook. 38 minutes from Wolf inbound, and 95th to the interchange is 17 minutes on the Ryan, and 30 minutes from 294 to the Ryan on the Stevenson. Hawks lose to the Hurricanes at home. That was 4-2. White Sox lose to the Royals at home. That was 2-0. Cubs win at Diamondbacks, and Angel Reese drafted by the Sky. So that's welcome to Chicago, Angel Reese. That's all I got, Chief.
They got she was the second or second picks. They got somebody good in the first pick too.
Somebody's
like 6'6" or something.
I'm seeing Angel Reese picked 7th by the Sky.
I think they had the number 2 pick or 3 pick too.
All right, great.
Maybe not. Anyway, so we have Aaron. Aaron, how are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are y'all? Thank you for having me.
We're doing great. You have to do what Joel does every week. Tell us where the market's going and what are we doing here. We got VIX is up to. Joel's kind of an expert on the VIX. We've got the VIX up. It was over 19. Now it's down. We just turned up here a little bit. It's down to 18.77. But that's a high number. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, I mean, two big red days in a row on Friday and Monday. I mean, you never, depending on what type of investor you are, you never like to see that unless you're, of course, someone that's out there shorting the market. But yeah, I mean, you have a lot of uncertainty right now, things going on around the world, obviously. And in addition to that, I mean, the market did very well in Q1. I mean, the S&P 500 went up more than 9% in the first quarter, which is typically its whole yearly gain. So I don't think it's, that shocking to see some sort of a pullback, especially again, when you have all this underlying uncertainty, which is also why you're seeing the VIX usually goes up when you have these red days and when people are a little bit more scared. But I think a lot of people will see two red days in a row like this and start freaking out about the market, think, oh my god, the next crash is coming, this is it, we're entering a bear market. But I mean, at the end of the day, we see these pullbacks a lot.
The we were just mentioning, Carl and I, older dudes than you, are just we're opining kind of on what you were talking about, and it's anybody who's in the business for like the last 10-15 years, every one of these sell-offs has just been an amazing opportunity, right? Yet this time, when you're talking about the 10-year rates, you know, we're pushing 5. It's kind of a different world than when they were 1.5, 3 years ago. And the odd part is, and I just want you as a you know, kind of a younger guy's assessment of things, we can't wait all day long on all the talk shows for the interest rates to get cut, and yet the market's actually up since they've been raised. And what do you make of that?
Well, I think it's important to note that the reason that interest rates are this high and the reason the Fed hasn't been able to cut rates like their plan has been is because the economy is strong. And at the end of the day, you know, stocks tend to do well when the economy is strong. Interest rates are not. So had the economy slowed down like Powell had expected, and we saw unemployment tick higher and we saw spending slow down, the Fed would have cut rates by now. But that hasn't happened. And that's why the Fed has essentially been forced to keep rates this high. So, you know, I mean, look, people all have different goals in investing in the market, and people that are maybe closer to retirement, maybe you take that, you know, free 5%, you know, but for myself, you know, like I'd always more be exposed to more equities, more stocks compared to the interest rates. You know, and so again, I mean, like, I think it's important, you know, instead of getting scared off by the interest rates, understanding why they're this high. And if we do end up seeing that slowdown that's people have been calling for now for 2 years, and Powell even said himself, we're going to see pain in the labor market, and we haven't seen that, then those rates should start to come down.
Well, I think there's those numbers, and the gentleman was on just before you. We go through the labor numbers every month, and there's reasons for concern in there. I mean,
no doubt. I'm just saying from the point of view from when the Fed started raising rates, right, above 3%, above 3.5% to 4%. Even the guy in charge of all this, Powell, was saying that we were going to see unemployment tick higher, and instead the opposite happened. Unemployment went lower. And again, from an overall standpoint, not that there's no reason to be concerned or any, you know, frightening numbers. Overall, the economy has held up a lot better than I think most people have expected, which again is the reason why we're seeing the Fed now delay all these interest rate cuts.
Well, I don't disagree with you, and I have an issue. I'm a monetary theory guy from way back, right? So I think the Fed. This is one man's opinion. You can use it or throw it out as you wish. The incredible injection of money into the system in an 18-month to 2-year period during the COVID was 40%. They didn't even really do that in wartime. So you've jumped the inflation number so high that I don't even know. You and I don't even, when we talk about these numbers, I'm not sure we even know what we're talking about, because if you all of a sudden say that instead of their inflation number over the last 4 years, instead of being 18.5-19%, is really more like 35 or 40, which I think maybe even you would agree 18.5 or 19 is a little low. If it's somewhere in the middle and you increase your deflator, all of a sudden the gross numbers don't look so hot. And I don't think anybody. I can't even say you're wrong, because I've never seen anything like this in history where they put that much money into the system. Whereas I can't tell if the numbers are good or bad, honestly. I mean, the amount of, like car sales, for instance, the numbers look great. The amount of cars go down. The amount of people can afford them are down. It's weird. I mean, I can't argue with you. I think you're probably right. It's just really hard to put a finger on any number. I mean, you have any idea? I mean, I know you have an idea what I'm talking about. Do you think there's any truth in what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably frustrating for a lot of Americans to hear, you know, people say, oh, the economy is doing great, when they don't feel like it's doing great for the reasons that you're mentioning, right? Prices are a lot higher. People, you know, but again, I think, you know, at the very least, people aren't, you know, losing their jobs left and right. Like we haven't entered this recessionary period, at least not yet. And I think, you know, as long as prices can stay, you know, I think the growth in prices, I mean, that's what inflation is tracking. It's year over year growth in prices. So if prices stay the same from here to this point next year, they'll still be a lot higher than we were before COVID in 2020 or 2019. Right. And inflation will show 0%, even though we all know the prices are still higher. So I have problems with how the inflation is calculated and how the government does that. Of course, I don't think it's perfect, and there's, you know, a lot of issues with it. But you know, I think from where we're at now, like, that's the big key for me right now. As long as prices don't continue growing at the rate we were growing at, and like you mentioned, I mean, if we start deflating too quickly, that's usually not a good sign, right?
Oh, yeah, well, that I'm sure is not the solution, right? I agree with you there, right? The Fed, I'm kind of paraphrasing what you're saying. I don't know if they have necessarily a huge inflation problem. They have a monster price level problem. That's a different animal.
I would agree with that 100%. And again, though, I mean, if prices can stay where they're at, and then you typically see some, you know, modest wage growth, you know, maybe like eventually. But, I mean, going back to the COVID times, I mean, the Fed has a dual mandate, right, between inflation and unemployment. When COVID hit, that dual mandate went out the window, and their job was to make sure people weren't out in the streets rioting because everyone lost their jobs and people still had enough food to eat and had places to live. And so, I mean, it really was, I mean, I know the word unprecedented, it got used way too much, but it was really an unprecedented time. So, you know, the central bank's job at that time wasn't really to follow its dual mandate. Mm-hmm. It was to just kind of keep things going the best they could. And I think looking back on it, I mean, you know, there's obviously...
We got a dash here. I mean, I think they would definitely agree with your assessment. That they did it right, and that's just where it landed. I well, you know what, we're gonna have you back on and talk more about that, because it's interesting. I mean, I love your point of view. By the way, tell Joel we miss him, but I loved having you, buddy. Well, let's have you back.
I wanted to talk some sports too next time. Maybe
that's right.
Are you guys Cubs fans or Sox fans?
Nobody can be a Sox fan, no.
Okay, we'll talk some baseball at some point, because I'm a Cardinals fan, so maybe we can get into it and have some.
One question, yeah. Are the Sox going to lose more than the 62 Mets?
How many games did the 62 Mets lose?
I think it was like 120, I'm not sure. I got to go look it up before I keep asking people.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, the Sox are in some trouble, definitely. But,
all right, bud. Well, have a good one. Say hi to Joel if he calls in. What do you say we go right to Kenny, Greg, because we're a little over?
Thanks for having me on, guys.
No problem.
You got it.
Kenny, you with us?
I am.
I'd love getting the younger dude's view of all this, and it is interesting. I mean, because Carl and I were talking before about how what age you are, how you look at what's happening in front of you, I started the conversation by saying when I started in '81, nobody even understand the mentality people had back then. Never buy a stock. The rates are always going to be high. Stocks have done nothing but go down for 13 years. Why would anyone put money in a stock unless you worked for AT&T and they gave you some, you know, basically? And now the mentality is absolutely spun the other way. And yet times were kind of a changing in 82, and they look like they're kind of changing again now. Okay, but nobody's going to believe it until all of a sudden something bad happens.
No, well, listen, they are changing, but you and I have been talking about this. Honestly, it's about time that it's changing, because it was artificial to begin with. We were all very frustrated with, you know, what was happening, how they were controlling it, what the Fed was doing, what they weren't doing. Talk of rate cuts only fueled the further advance, which, you know, I thought was illogical to begin with. And now I think they're trying to really manage that narrative, because now they got the big investment banks. You know, UBS came out with a report to say that the potential next move could be up. Societe Generale came out and said they see no rate cuts in 2024. You know, they feed it out as they try to test the market and prepare the market for what I thought was always going to be the case. I don't see how they could have cut rates. Given all the economic data the way it is, given the spending that the administration is doing, giving all the inflationary effects that's going to create. And, you know, the last 3 months we've had, January, February, March now, we've had an uptrend in month-over-month inflation, which is exactly what you and I discussed maybe 4 or 5 months ago when I said I was concerned about a repeat of, you know, the 1979-1980 inflation story, where they thought they beat it, they cut rates prematurely, inflation reared its ugly head, and then Paul Volcker had to jam rates right up everyone's backside to 21% to kill the economy for 2 years and ultimately bring rates back to normal. So I was always a little bit fearful that they were going to do the same thing. I'm hopeful that they don't, I'm hopeful that they just keep rates here. They don't necessarily, I don't think they have to go up, but I think they have to stay here, and they have to stay here longer. So,
well, I think they somehow have to back off on the money supply.
The market is now, you know, kind of repricing itself, I think, based on that narrative. Certainly there's geopolitical tensions, which also is adding to that anxiety. But you and I both also know that geopolitical tensions cause short-term chaos, but don't typically price stocks in the long term, right?
Right.
And so savvy investors would be, you know, be wise to be strategic, but be ready to pounce and take advantage of the chaos.
Well, you have to be careful that a stock isn't up 200% and it drops 5% and all of a sudden it's a screaming buy. Okay.
Well, and that's some always of that mentality. The problem.
Yeah.
Right. But that's always been the problem. The market would back off, you know, 2.5% and all the buy the difference. Oh, my God, this is our opportunity. Meanwhile, I'm laughing. Well, down 2% or 2.5% is not the buy the dip opportunity.
Oh, right.
It's when the stock of the market is down 10, 12, 15%. And you've seen that, by the way, in some stocks. Apple was off nearly 10%. I think Apple is in that area again where I think you can start picking away at it right now. Do I think there could be further weakness ahead? Sure, because I think if the broader market gets weak, certainly every stock will get weak. But Apple's already reacted. Apple's already down 10%. And it's Apple. They make $120 billion every 3 months. Where is it going? Right, so where's it going? Down another 3 or 4%.
How much, Kenny? How much do you think? I mean, I'm not. We have a lot of people. I mean, obviously they have Apple, but I can't figure out with them, you know, kind of switching countries and the China issues and all the other stuff. The growth, I think the price increases have really helped them, as they have helped a lot of people. But I don't see the growth like 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I mean, I don't know that they should be priced. And they're really not priced anymore like a big growth stock, but they're still sort of priced like a growth stock, are they?
Right. Well, yeah, it's interesting. Is it a growth stock or is it a growth? I still think there's some aspect to it of which you could say Apple's still a growth stock. But look, I also think it's a very mature global company, right?
Right.
So it's going to start to fall back into this more, you know, more. Not so much growth, but just kind of a core holding, right? People will use it as an ATM. It's easy to raise cash. Their asset managers can use it as an ATM. They're going to raise cash quick. They can, you know, sell it quick. It's very liquid, you know, just like they do in a bunch of other big mega cap stocks. And we're already seeing that happen. But to your point, you know, will the growth continue to be what it is? Probably not. It's got to slow. But I got to tell you, yesterday when they talked about, you know, they're down, their shipments are down 10%, and now there's all this Chinese competition. I got news for you. I am not buying a Chinese cell phone. The same I'm not buying.
Oh, no. Neither am I. I'm not an Apple guy, but I'm just not doing it.
Now, maybe Russia will. Maybe Iran will. Maybe Chinese will buy the Chinese phone. I'm not friggin' buying a Chinese cell phone. As bad as it is, Apple tracks everything we do anyway. But I'm not giving the Chinese, an open end into you know, my life, your life, anyone else's life. I am not buying a Chinese product.
Well, I agree with you. I just wonder, you know, at some point, you know, that's one of the reasons I think why you and I love the business so much is companies get in, they're growth companies, they got great ideas, blah blah blah, and all even Nvidia, they're ahead of the game. I mean, they clearly got ahead of the game. Maybe they lucked out by the AI just happened to work on their. And there's stuff that was like video game chips or whatever it was, and you know they got ahead. Maybe they didn't even plan on being ahead, but they got ahead, and all of a sudden and they're running with it. And I have no problem with that. But the idea that you give anybody, NVIDIA is not going to be this way 5 years from now. There's going to be people who figure out. What, I mean, all of a sudden, but then you get priced differently. And if you can invest in such a way where you figure out when all of a sudden eBay, you could never short that damn thing how many years ago. You get carried up
right.
by your feet, and all of a sudden one day, it's just a retailer. You know, I mean, all of a sudden people just go, it doesn't look to me like it's doing much other than being a retailer. And all of a sudden it's just kind of priced different. But Kenny, you got to help me out on one thing. My worst call from a client, well, there's a lot of worst calls. I mean, if somebody loses money, which hopefully they don't do. But, I mean, a bad call. I've all these years I've been in a business, I can judge a lot of companies because I used to do a lot of, you know, capital asset stuff when I was working for places. I cannot figure out for the life of me how to value these banks. I mean, people have these different ratios they use and stuff. I can't tell if these guys, the stories they come out with, all of a sudden the interest rates are killing them, and all of a sudden the interest rates aren't killing them. And they're not, they're writing off loans. All of a sudden they didn't write off as many as they thought they were going to write off. I mean, I can add value to these places to save my life.
No, I hear you, which is why I don't go too far down the bank scale, right? I own two banks, J.P. Morgan and Bank of America. Those are the only two I own. I follow them, you know, closely. Jamie Dimon, I think, is a superstar. But you're right. Every quarter when they report, it's confusing because they shift to a different metric. And so you're right. I don't really know. All I know is that I know what I know about J.P. Morgan in terms of its management, in terms of its growth rate, in terms of kind of how it performs over the long term. And so I stick with it. But I don't own other names down the scale individually. I own some of them through the XLF, but individually, JP Morgan and Bank of America are the two ones. But yes, to your point, I'm not sure because every quarter it changes, right? What's important this quarter versus what's important last quarter, right? Net interest income versus loan loss reserves. Are they increasing loan loss reserves? And what does that say about what they think about the economy going forward? If they're increasing them, that means they become more cautious. They're not increasing them, means they become, you know, a little bit more aggressive, I guess, right? Or less concerned.
But you and I talked 2 weeks ago about how some of these debt things are going vertical. I mean, in terms of, you know, auto payments, the amount of foreclosures is up. Repossessions, whatever you want to call them. We're talking about consumer credit. Looks to me like it's a line going up. I mean, how bad they are, the Fed bails them out. So, I mean, it's hard to say they're not going to do very well. The four big ones are way bigger than anybody ever said they were going to be. They're all breaking laws in terms of size. Nobody seems to care. I mean, we have some people in the XLF and those kinds of things, but man, I'd be really hard pressed to say, boy, go out and buy Wells Fargo today. It's the best one. I just can't figure it out.
No, I hear you. I mean, like I said, the only two names I own are those two. JP Morgan's a little bit stretched, in my opinion, at the moment. I own it. I'm not changing it up here. Bank of America, they just came out with their earnings. They beat again. I think the stock's down 1 or 2%. I'll probably stick my toes in the water again and buy a little bit more Bank of America today as a result. I just want to see how the market opens and what the market feels like this morning, because I think futures are under pressure. European markets are all down better than 1.5%. Asian markets closed lower. So I suspect maybe there's a little bit more push. Especially now after we broke through 51 on the S&P, which was a trend line and a technical break point, which then sends a message out to all the algos that trade off technical patterns that they need to be more conservative and raise cash. And so they do that by just hitting the sell button. So I want to see how the tone feels this morning when we open.
Well, I was questioning, we don't have time to go into this huge thing, but I'll probably go into it with Hal a little more. What do you make of these... You know, on the war footing, Iran looks to me their currency. And I'm sorry to hitch up with this, but you probably know what I'm reading here. Their currency is down a boatload in the last 4 months. How do they even sell anything over there to get money to do what they're doing? I mean, I don't understand how the hell these places that are run so poorly can possibly be right doing a war with somebody. Other than that's what keeps you in power, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I think that's your answer. That's what keeps you in power, right? And they'll just, I mean, do they do the same thing we do? They just print money and just give it so they can do it?
Their money supply is going up.
I'm not really sure.
Their money supply is going up 30% a year. Their money supply is going up.
And inflation's 30% a year. Yeah, sure.
Well, duh. They match up. How come nobody seems to know that except you and me these days?
Yeah.
double your money supply, you double the prices. It's not all that confusing, is it? But I mean, just wonder what life's like for. What's life like for a regular person over there? I mean, it can't be.
I have no idea. But in Turkey, it's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Turkey has also out of control inflation. And I was there a year ago, and they do everything. It's like a black market. The Turks are all paying cash. Then no one's using their credit cards or their debit cards or any of that. It's all like a black market economy over there in Istanbul. But I think it's because inflation is just out of control. So I'm not sure how they really do it. I only spent a day and a half there, so I didn't get a chance to spend a whole lot of time. But what the people I did talk to are all very concerned. But yet they seem to exist, right? They seem to pay their bills. They seem to, put food on their table because they do it, hustle and bustle. But to your point, inflation is out of control.
If you pull out U.S. currency, are they in love with you when you're buying something?
They are, yes. They are actually, anything I bought, they asked me if I would pay $1.
Oh, yeah, well, that's probably how they're, hanging in there.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So I did for the. I didn't buy anything big, but the stuff I did buy, I did pay in dollars, right? I mean, they were trying to sell me, you know, carpets, all that stuff. Dude, I don't need carpets. Are you kidding me? I don't need to go home with a carpet on my back. No, thank you. But
I'll bet they were nice.
They're beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
They're beautiful. But I have to tell you, I have a house full of them. We've had them for years. I said I don't need any more of these carpets.
Well, you know, the ones that are. Farah used to say the ones that are really pristine, like the real hand woven wool jobs.
Yeah,
you don't put them on a floor. You hang them on the wall.
You hang them on the wall. Yeah. Well, the ones I have are on the floor, so I guess mine aren't so pristine.
Well, hey, you don't walk in when it's snowing outside and trample over those things.
No, but I'm in Florida now, so there's no snow outside.
Well, that's true. Well, Kenny, hopefully next week when we talk, we won't. I'm very confused at what the Iranians exactly did this weekend.
Well, I got to tell you something. I'm glad you brought that up because I actually think the whole thing was very orchestrated, right? They publicized it. They told everyone what they were going to do, including even the Arab neighbors.
Yeah.
They told them what they were going to do because I think they wanted to make. They wanted to have this show of force, but I don't really think they wanted to elevate it. And so in fact, they didn't. When they launched it, everyone shot their stuff down, including their Arab neighbors, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and the UAE, all, you know, jumping in and helping to mute the attack. So I think it's really, I'm beginning to think, you know, it's all just pounding our chest and now waiting to see what Israel's going to do back, right? They're probably going to hit a proxy. I don't think they're going to hit Tehran or Iran directly if they do anything. So it's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds.
Well,
we can talk about that next week.
Are we going to have to, some might say, again, I don't, this is like, this is mindful of me, Kenny, being Irish, the Irish and the Brits. Who the hell could figure out who fired the first shot? Everything was a retaliatory strike for 100
exactly.
years. I mean, it sounds to me lately, maybe the Israelis shot at the embassy, which is sovereign property in Damascus, might have been the first shot here. Now, granted, you go back before that and say, you know, the Iran's backed these guys and that guy. So it's very difficult to figure out. But in terms of hitting other people's land here themselves, it looks like maybe the Israelis did something and now the Iranians did something and maybe they could call it off right here. I mean, is that even possible?
I'm not sure it's possible. I think that you know Israel has to do something just to show them their people and the world that they're just not going to sit back. Which listen, I agree, I understand, I understand. But what I don't want to see, and I don't think anyone wants to see, is really the conflict explode because it is a tinderbox over there, and it could get really really ugly.
Well, I looked up. Feel free to use this number, Kenny. The closest point between the two countries is 1,300 miles.
Yeah, right.
Over other
1,300 miles. That's like New York to Florida.
Yeah, over other people's places.
Right.
I mean, you got to fly over Jordan. You got to fly over Saudi Arabia. Yeah. You got to fly over Syria or someplace.
Right. And so that's what they did. You know, before they launched this strike, they told all these countries, here's what we're going to do. And then Jordan and Saudi Arabia helped to bring down a lot of those missiles because they were flying over airspace, right?
I'll bet 25% of them just crashed on their own.
Right. Might have. Yeah, might have. They wouldn't tell you that, but it's might have.
1,300 miles is a long time for a drone. It's a long way.
You know, I was in Bali 2 weeks ago, and to get there, we flew from Miami to Turkey. Turkey to Bali, but when we were flying from Turkey to Bali, we had to fly over that zone. We had to fly over kind of Iran, Iraq, Syria, that whole where it all comes together. And I didn't tell my wife we were going there because we were flying over there because she would have lost her mind.
Well, anyway, they've lost a couple of passenger jets in that area. Oops.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. Kenny, talk at you next week. SP Futures up 11, NASDAQ up 22. We've got a very short break. We'll bring back the Professor Helsner.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices, along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control. Right here, right now, right here.
All right, trying to figure out who that was. SP Futures, up 10, Nasdaq Futures up 20. All right, tell me the song before I drive me nuts. Greg. Can't hear you.
Vehicle?
Yeah, who did that?
Ides of March.
That's right.
Jim Petterick.
Yeah, you know, you've got the, I've got it in the back of my head, and that's right where it is, in the back of my head. Hal, how are you, buddy?
I did well.
You watching all the news and all this stuff?
Yeah, well, I'm traveling. I'm in Columbia, Missouri today.
Really?
I flew from New York to Kansas City last night, and then I had a really fun time at the rental car place in Kansas City. I was there for a couple hours, and then I got into my hotel last night around midnight, so...
Well, there you go. Then you're up and ready.
It's having fun here.
What is in Columbia, Missouri?
I'm visiting with a college today.
Okay, good for you.
Explore my options, my career options.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
We could always be like a talking head on CNBC, you know, all this stuff.
I mean, that'd be all right. I could see myself doing it, but I don't think I would be very welcome.
You gotta find the right station.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, my wife and I, when we first moved to Utah, the president of the college, Westminster College, he knew I was a libertarian. He goes, "Hal, would you like to be a part of a panel discussion up in Park City regarding the minimum wage?" And I go, "Yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun." And I'm up there on stage at this church. It's being held in a Presbyterian church up in Park City, Utah. And to my right is a Republican. And then the rest of the people are pretty progressive. And then there's a lawyer / Democrat representative in the House. I think he represents Salt Lake City at the state level, not the state level, but at the state level. And we were talking about the minimum wage, and I was, you know, providing my insights into it, you know, my libertarian insights into it. And as the evening went on, the Republican sitting next to me, he physically moved toward his.
They all moved away from you, and all of a sudden you're like in the middle of the panel, and there's a big space, and you're starting to grow.
I'm on one side, and everybody else is like inched their chair away from me, right? And at one point, I'm talking about something. When you hear libertarian theory for the first time, like I did, I was like, "What is that guy talking about?" And I was in the middle. I was in mid sentence, and the power went out. And I joked to the audience, "Man, even God doesn't like what I have to say."
Well, there you go. By the way, your view of the economic world is very, very similar to a young Milton Friedman's.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah,
and you and I, when we disagree, we always disagree. I think we always disagree on the same issue, and I'm going to say what the issue is, and you can tell me I'm wrong, as I usually am, is that when you talk about minimum wage theory, okay, well, a couple of things. I mean, there's always people that are messing with the minimum wage theory. I don't think Roosevelt was wrong, for instance, by saying you can't have people at 14 work. You got to be 16. You know, yeah. Which the real thing was, if you get those people, people, kids, out of the labor force, you drop the supply of labor, and oh, by the way, somewhere along the line, you're going to have to increase how much you pay people because there's less people around. Well, I don't think you should be taking advantage of. There needs to be some sort of rule someplace. I mean, minimum, I agree with you, but here's my concern with. I mean, if you and I were to sit there and discuss, like, if the proctor, now you can't be the proctor and turn around and sit next to me as a student. You got to be one or the other. But if the proctor says, "Hey, you two bozos," meaning you and me, debate minimum wage theory in a competitive economy, I'm going to say you and I are lockstep in theory and in practice. And we're not going to disagree on anything. Be the worst radio show ever because there's not going to be any disagreement at all. Yet, I, for some reason, maybe it's my experience and what I've been in versus what you, I think as you get less and less competitive in all these different industries, all of a sudden, I'm not so sure that the who gets paid what is competitive at all. You know, when you have people that are making, you know, $4 million a year for doing God knows what, and only in their own mind, trying as best they can to pay somebody $10 an hour instead of $11, you know, and doing whatever they can to the market to make sure that the 10 is okay instead of the 11. I don't know if that's competitive enough to where we're in the same world as we were in our discussion before that. I mean, I'll give you a crazy example, Al. Somebody, you know, in Washington's this whatever kind of state they are. I mean, Washington came out to say, you remember this was like 4 or 5, I think it was before COVID, maybe. The airport in Seattle. Now, if you know anything about Chicago politics, the people who get the bars and the magazine stands and all that crap at the airport are like really well connected, right? And you couldn't, unless you gambled it away right when you walked out of the place, you couldn't lose money there, hell, to save your life. I mean, what do they charge for a beer at Midway? Matter of fact, the bar I used to go to, the owners, their only little bar now is about a 10-stool place in Midway. They got rid of the regular bar. Why do that when you can charge, you know, $15 a beer at Midway? So, In Seattle, they came out and said, for anybody who works in the airport, they wanted the minimum wage to be $19.50 an hour. I'm sitting there going, what? 19? This is a while ago. It's before all this inflation. And I start to think, well, wait a minute. They must know that these dudes are making so much money there that the idea of having some poor guy or girl going out there having to park at the airport to work there and making $12 an hour is an absolute, you know, abortion in the world. I mean, and it probably in that little area there, for those guys to use their economic power to do that, I think is pretty hideous. You know, now because you made one thing wrong, and that the contract or for the bar was not competitive, now do you have to follow it all the way through and make sure the other stuff isn't competitive so it's, quote, fair? And I think there's a lot of that going on, you know, and there shouldn't be, but there is. I mean, if you had an auction for the bar space, you wouldn't have to worry about that, right? But you don't. You give it to people who you like or who paid you money for it. So once you start screwing with the economy, I almost think you got to keep screwing with it, or else, you know, what do you talk?
Well, I studied this issue with Colorado and Utah with a former student of mine, and Utah doesn't have a state minimum wage law. Colorado does. And in the year that Colorado hiked its minimum wage to highest, it had the largest negative impact on the people, on the businesses that generally hire low-wage workers in that one year. And it had no effect on the rich counties of Colorado, because we broke it down by, we had the county split into, you know, low, medium low, medium high, and high income counties by county median household income. And the minimum wage law had no impact on wealthy counties, you know, located near ski resorts or fancy neighborhoods.
Well, if your wage is already above the minimum wage, doesn't do anybody anything.
Yeah. But boy, it had a really huge negative impact on the employers. Because we didn't include labor into it. We included the number of firms with certain numbers of employees. You know, we had small firms, medium-sized firms, large firms. And what we found is that it really impacted the number of firms in the poorer counties. So when you put a blanket minimum wage across the United States, you're probably going to have no effect in a place like California.
Right.
Or New York. But, man, when you get into Wyoming, where the cost of living is really, really low, you impose a, say, a $15 minimum wage in Wyoming, I think you decimate the economy. You create all kinds of unemployment.
Well, from the political side.
But you probably have no effect in New York City.
Well, Carol, if you and I were the two-headed monster running, say, Illinois, if we notice that the market rate is 12 and the minimum wage is 9, we should score all the political points we want by raising it to 10.
Yeah.
Because we're not going to do any good except being able to say how much we're raising it, right?
Yeah.
Yet it's already above
that. You
got
to be really careful. You got to be really careful with the politicians pushing this law, too, because I think there was a Republican. I remember reading this article about a Republican in the 1960s in Long Island who was advocating for a national minimum wage or increasing it. And he was probably doing it because he saw firms leaving his districts or the state of New York for places like Alabama where the wages were really, really low. And so his thinking was, well, we're going to impose this national minimum wage right below the New York wage to discourage firms from leaving New York State, right? And then you have the situation in South Africa where the white-only labor unions, according to Walter Williams, the great deceased Walter Williams, he did this research in South Africa where the white labor unions of South Africa were losing out jobs to lower wage black workers in South Africa. And they supported raising the minimum wage. Why? Because they wanted, you know, firms that were not colorblind. When profits and discrimination compete, profits win, right? So these discriminating firms, non-colorblind firms, they were hiring black labor because it was cheaper, right? So the white-only labor unions were advocating for a higher minimum wage to make that decision easier to discriminate against the black workers, right? So you got to look at the intentions of people. And the minimum wage law has a history in the United States of being very racist.
If you have a right-to-work state, it makes a big difference too.
Yeah. But if you look at the history of the minimum wage law, if anybody wants this paper, I can circulate it. Just direct message me on Twitter. But there was a paper published in the Journal of Economic Perspectives from a professor from Princeton who looked at the history of the minimum wage and was very racist. The progressives in the Republicans and Democrat Party of the early 20th century, late 19th century, literally said things like, we need to raise the minimum wage to make it more difficult for the unfit races. Their words, not mine, to find employment.
Well,
they were basically wanting them not to reproduce.
I mean, the example Milton Friedman used to use was if the back in those days, the airlines were regulated, and they competed on other things.
They were regulated to the point where they literally had monopolies.
Well, it was a cartel.
Routes.
Yeah, but everybody charged the same amount.
Yeah.
So in order,
I mean, I'm talking about the route. Like somebody owned the route from, only one airline could fly from like L.A. to Hawaii, for example, right?
Yeah, but it was two or three. But yeah, and they all had to charge the same amount.
Yeah.
And so you competed and you know, some of it wasn't so horrible, I guess. They competed on food. They competed on how hot the waitress or the stewardesses were.
Yeah. I mean, that's how Southwest Airlines got its start, right?
Well, Braniff, the stews had to weigh in like once a month, and they all wore Armani gowns.
Yeah.
And you know, the food was spectacular. Service was great. It cost way more, but
all the rich people could afford it, too.
Well, I mean, the people, or if you're, you know, did on business. But I'm saying somewhere, a lot of this, when you don't have a competitive area, a lot of this kind of falls apart. I mean, you and I know that, say, the Tripoli Tap, the local watering hole, there's a bunch of bars in the neighborhood. You and I don't have to regulate how much Nick pays himself, the guy who owns the place, or the two guys that own the place. If they paid themselves $1 million, guess what? They're out of business, right? They can't do that. But now, if you were to say...
They'd be out of business really quick.
Yeah, but now if you were to say, we're going to cut the amount of bars in half to where they can raise their prices because now it's non-competitive, they might be making $1 million. Is it still right they paid a bartender $12 an hour? You and I might say, man, we didn't really expect all that money to go right to the top, but some places it has. I mean, the most egregious was railroads. I mean, nothing could be more non-competitive. I mean, if you and I wanted to get a railroad out of Chicago, here's one for you. What was the first railroad out of Chicago?
Probably New York.
No. Chicago to Galena, because there were silver mines.
Oh, really? Wow.
There were silver mines in Galena. You know, and the other ones came right afterward. But now, if you and I were to put that railroad in, and our buddy Greg Pappas had a farm somewhere along the line, said, hey, how about getting my corn to market in Chicago, where the Board of Trade is now at its fledgling, and it was a delivery point there, and you and I own the railroad, he says, how much? And we say, how much you got? there's no road. There's no other railroad. So after this became egregious for a while, because the government gave the property to the railroad to build it. So they're saying, we didn't make you do this, so all you could do is put everybody else out of business.
I would say the government gave certain people the land, but there was some serious bribing going on. There was a guy, I remember reading the Progressive Era book by Murray Rothbard, and there was a guy that in the 1800s, I think probably 1860 or 1870s, going around D.C., and he was unapologetic. He had like $400,000 in his suitcase, and he was just passing out money to bribe the senators or whoever it was to get the rights or the land for a certain railroad. So it was pretty unapologetic.
Well, you know, they would give you a certain amount of land, and your job was to sell off some pieces of what they gave you to build the railroad, because you didn't have the money and the government didn't want to give it to you.
Well, that's the whole premise behind the movie Blazing Saddles, right?
Yeah, well, but that's what... Matter of fact, we are jumping around, but the point being is it's... You mentioned the airlines. It was the same thing. If there was one airline going from Chicago to Las Vegas, say, which probably would have been United, they're charging X. But now if there's three airlines going from Chicago to L.A., and if they're allowed to, if they're competing, they might be charging half of what the price is to go to Vegas. Or if there's only one airline going to Cleveland, it might have cost you more to get to Cleveland than it did to L.A. So the government sees that this is basically a circle bleep, says, wait a minute. We're going to do this by miles. If Cleveland is 400 miles and L.A. is, 900 or 1,200 miles, you're going to charge a third as much to go to Cleveland as you're... So they try to put some method to the madness by fixing the prices in a way where if you were the only railroad in the area, you couldn't charge four times as much to haul somebody's corn as if there were two railroads. Or if there was an actual highway, which, obviously became the competition that allowed them to deregulate the railroads. Because up until then, when there was no highway... But, it's all about monopoly power. And when you create the monopoly, then you got to... nobody would allow Commonwealth Edison, even though they get there anyway because they pay everybody off. Nobody would allow Commonwealth Edison to set the rates wherever they damn well please when you gave them the monopoly, right? So I'm saying the whole economy, there's pockets of perfect competition where you and I agree on everything. Then there's pockets that are sort of mixed bag. Then there's some that are full out controlled.
Every one of these connected billionaire types, like a Warren Buffett, for example, they have their politicians and they lobby those politicians for protection from the competition.
Right.
Here's an example.
Right.
You have Warren Buffett, who ships a lot of crude oil on his trains from Canada into United States. The guy was opposed to these oil pipelines. Why? Because the oil pipelines would cut into his business. So he's lobbying. I don't think he's doing it for environmental sakes.
No.
I don't think he's doing it for environmental concerns. He's doing it because he's making a lot of money by transporting the oil on his trains, right?
Right.
And that, I think that's actually worse for the environment than a pipeline, right? I think a pipeline is pretty safe when you're transporting, raw material like crude oil, right?
Well, the only issue with that particular pipeline is that none of it was for U.S. oil, which is a little weird. It was a real sandy stuff to come out of the tar sands. But I got a good one for you. I don't know if I told you this before. What's the fracking place down in Texas?
Is it like Brownsville or something?
No. What's the name of it? The Bakken's up in Dakota. What's the one down there? There's the huge field. It's not the Bakken. It's whatever the hell they call it. I'll think of it. The one in Texas. There was a railroad, allegedly, in I don't know what year, 1880, 1890, somewhere in there. They were going to go from Dallas out west No, the only real railroad, there's only like four passes getting out west. There's a Southern Pacific, there's a Santa Fe, and there's the one that now goes through the Moffett Tunnel. But before then, you had the Union Pacific, which was the original railroad, and then you had one up north. There's only one pass up there. They all use the same tunnel, I think. Well, these guys were going to go from Fort Worth and Western was going to be the name of the place. So they get all this land granted to them by the U.S. government. They get some investors. I'm thinking ridiculously how they made it like 15, 20 miles, maybe more than that. It wasn't very much. And said, screw it. But now the land is still theirs. And the shares are worth zero for, you know, decades. I think this basin that they're getting all the oil out of, a lot of it's the land that was granted to this railroad company that never did anything. And now all of a sudden the shareholders are getting money every month from this oil where they never built the railroad. We should have bought some of that stock 40 years ago. I mean, all of a sudden, yeah. You can't.
Where's the DeLorean time machine when you need it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the economy is so mixed bag with stuff that is given a monopoly. I mean, I would say that anybody who's working at Pfizer, if you're sweeping the floor, you should be making $25 an hour, considering all these other people make there, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
I've been thinking about this a lot when I teach my microeconomics classes. I think about this a lot. In the textbooks, they always talk about pure competition. There's no barriers to entry. And the books never really talk about what are the barriers to entry. And the barriers to entry are governments, government regulations, rules, licensing, and whatnot, right?
Well, it could be. And so it could be you're the only one who can put a bridge over a certain spot. All of a sudden, now you can pay. Yeah. You know, I mean, it could be a lot of barriers. I mean, it could be just the capital needed, you know.
Well, I mean, when you're talking about a bridge, you're talking about a government's favored contractor, right?
Yeah.
And that contractor probably getting the government to violate people's property rights to purchase land, like in Brooklyn, New York, when they built the Barclays Center. They evaded people's, violated people's property rights and took these buildings that people had owned for decades.
You can blame your Supreme Court for that.
Yeah. They essentially just took these people's property rights so they could build, and the city was all in favor of it.
At fair value, they would tell you that at fair value.
Yeah.
Now, whether it was or not, I did some work.
And Trump did the same thing. He tried doing the same thing to some guy, I think, in Atlantic City, right? The guy wouldn't sell, right? There's a guy that owns property near the Augusta National Golf Course. And he won't sell. I think he died, and his wife is like in her 70s or 80s. They won't sell. But give it to Augusta. Augusta's not, you know, twisting the arms of politicians to force that sale, right? But, boy, I tell you, these other people in, like, New York and people who want to build a bridge or whatnot, they can twist the government's arm to force the sales, right?
It's in the Constitution. It's eminent domain. Yeah.
I think the way eminent domain is being used is it's not really being used for the public good. It's being used to benefit a very few people so that city councils can have higher property values and collect more in property tax. I don't think it's being used for the public good as it was intended. I think it's being abused.
Well, the original intent was you can take somebody's property. Matter of fact, I'm going to say that I don't know about recently. When I say recently, in the last however many years, the two biggest relocation of people projects ever were the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Dan Ryan Expressway in Chicago.
Yeah.
They bought, I don't know how many gazillion houses and stores and stuff. And now, supposedly, those were at fair value. And if you want to, there was a guy... he died not that long ago. I say not that long ago, probably 10 years ago. He had one of the biggest lawyer, what do they call them, books, when the lawyers are customers. And what they would do is they would, if you're going to, say, widen Irving Park Road or widen the tollway or something, they're going to have to give a piece of everybody's property. Maybe, you know, if it's 10 feet, it's 15 feet, whatever it is. It might be your whole house, depending on the whole shtick. And so they would Kevin just piled in. That's the Permian Basin. I was in.
Permian. Yeah.
Then all of a sudden they're going to say, okay, Hal's got a restaurant on Irving Park Road, and We need, he's got 100 feet of frontage, or 200 feet, whatever it is, 200 feet of frontage, and we're going to need 15 feet of that, so we're going to give Hal, we've got the goodness out of our hearts, 50 grand, or 25 grand, pick a number. Well, this attorney would say, that means I have eight less parking places, and if I have eight less parking places, village code says to me, I can only have four less tables now, or something, because I need the parking for the seating in the place, or something, whatever the code happens to be. Well, that's going to cost me 60 grand a year, you know, so your $50,000 offer is like a pretty crummy deal. So these law firms that do this will go in and say, we're gonna try and get you more than the 50, and they're pretty connected. And by the way, we'll take 25% or whatever we get, or 20 of the difference, and we won't charge anything. So all of a sudden, it comes down, and you get 200 grand. These guys get 40, and you now get 160 instead of 50. I mean, it's a massive undertaking. And the weird part is, if all of a sudden Greg has the restaurant right next to you with the identical frontage, the identical 15 feet, if you have the right law firm and now you get an extra 150, you get some, and if the attorney gets some, they're under no obligation or even a mindset to turn around to Greg and say, hey, we screwed up on the 50, we really should give you 150. They're not going to do that. Yeah. That's not going to happen. But then the Supreme Court decision said that you can take eminent domain and essentially take Greg's parking lot and make it a Hal parking lot. That was the first time. Because remember the guy put the, he used the term vandalized, Judge Souter. He was before he was left in it. He died, didn't he? I'm not sure. But he had his place he loved in Vermont, some like summer home or whatever, winter, whatever the hell he was doing in Vermont. Some guy went up there and hammered a big sign in his property, said something to the effect of coming Walmart or something. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm not into invading people's space, anything like that, but sometime, somewhere, someday, somehow, you have to bring this close to home to somebody. You know, what if this was your place and we decided for taxation purposes we wanted to put a Walmart here? We can just kick you out. I'm sure he never dreamed it could happen to him, you know, right? So I don't have to sign.
I think enforcing property rights is one of the few things I think government needs to do, but it has a history of not doing that. And here's a great example. Squatter rights have made the news lately, right? Squatter rights in New York City are, you know, you can occupy the space for 30 days and you can have a legitimate claim to somebody's abandoned property.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy.
In the rest of the state, it's a year, right? But here's the history of squatter rights. They go back to the 1800s. Jacksonian Democrats encouraged white people to squat on Native American lands and Mexican lands before, you know, territories were annexed to the United States. And they would use squatter rights to make claim to land. And it's kind of an abuse of the John Lockean idea of the person who toils the soil and makes it productive is the rightful property owner. So squatter rights have a racist history, like minimum wage laws have a racist history in the United States. And
well, they certainly have a lower person. I'm making 20 bucks an hour and somebody's not as good as I am at the job and is willing to work for five, you might hire him because of the difference. His 4 hours are worth more than one of mine. But if you say you got to pay him 15, you're going to say he's not worth 15. We'll stick with you with the 20. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, that happens. Hey, we come back. I got a great squatter story for you. And you'll know you'll know what I'm talking about. SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures up 14. You're right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Hear ye, hear ye! The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air!
Stocks, jocks,
Sparks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control!
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tim Allen, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 10. SP Futures up 20. We're going to try and make a day here to the upside here. We'll see how that goes. I mean, the rest of the world isn't exactly so hot. We're going to talk about right here. We've been down heavy 2 days in a row. Just a review before we start. Yesterday, Dow was down 248. S&P down 61. NASDAQ down 290. So we've given up in the S&P half of the gain on the year. And I think on the Dow might be pushing break even. NASDAQ still got to be up, but not like it was. Over in Europe, ouch here. DAX down 172, but it's a full 1%. FTSE down 99, it's 1.25%. CAC around down 74.9%. These are actually come back a little bit from like an hour ago. Over in Asia, Nikkei down 761, that's 2%. 38,471, you know, still high, but down from where it was. Hang Seng down 351, that's over 2%. 16,248, in danger of another day like that of going below 16,000. Shanghai, which has been fairly comfortably above 3,000, down 50 points to 3,007. So I wouldn't exactly call that comfortable anymore either. So big sell-offs over there. So, I mean, that's kind of important, I think, for us to at least hang in here today. We'll see if we do. Bonds, unchanged at 4.64. The Bund up 2 basis points, 2.45. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.88. We've got gold up 450, 2386. Still trying to come back from the big spin around on Friday, where it was up $60 and then ended up the day down. Silver down 38 cents, 28.32, but it's still high for silver. Copper down 7 cents, 4.30, so mixed bag there. We've got the U.S. dollar, which had been strong. It still is. The euro is 106.5, and the euro has been 108 like for a real long time. British pound, 124.6. It used to be, 127 there for a long time. So the dollar has strengthened. When we have crypto, up $65, 63,390. Still high in the year, but down from the 73,000 it was a couple weeks ago. A lot of stuff there, Greg. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports? Greg, are you there? Hope we didn't lose our producer.
Nope. I'll technical difficulties.
Were you Greg napped over there?
No.
All right.
You guys go on without me.
All right.
Frustrating.
All right. Well, Hal. I wonder when Greg gets back on, how much of this, I'm not going to say he remembers, but we talked about how property was given to railroads, correct? And they gave, I think one of the Burlington or one of those things that went on one of the northern routes. I think, I got some railroad book at home, I read all this stuff. And I think someplace, Burlington, they had a huge company called Burlington Resources, which they split off from the railroad. It was all the mining rights to all the land that they gave them to build the railroad. But I think they got 25 miles, 20 miles on each side of the line, something like that. I mean, not in the middle of nowhere, but I think, Hal, I'm going to guess 20% of all the land in this country was given to the five Western railroads.
Hold on, Hal, are you still there?
Yeah. He's there, but he's...
Okay, let's see. Hal, are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Sorry about that.
So, Hal, are you able to hear me there?
Oh, yeah, I'm hearing you. Yeah.
So one of the first times that was done, and Greg knows the history of this because he's a Board of Trade guy, in the 1850s or whenever it was, they built the I&M Canal, Illinois and Michigan Canal. And that was the reason why they basically hooked Lake Michigan up with the Des Plaines River and the Mississippi River, which is one of the biggest, right after the canal in New York, Erie Canal. I mean, this was a huge deal. When Father Marquette came through here, he thought it would the canal would have to be 5 miles, but the way the water is in Chicago, it ended up being like, you know, 50 miles or something, or more than that. Anyway, these guys dug it by hand, but they gave the company, whoever the hell the company was, I should read this stuff up, essentially, they cut up Chicago in square mile grids, and I think they gave them like every second or third square mile they gave to the I&M Canal Company to sell. Yeah. Of course, there was nobody here except, you know, Indians and Native Americans. So they managed to sell some, and anyways, they dig the canal. So that's why Chicago has a grid system. And the angle streets are Milwaukee Avenue, Elston Avenue, Ogden Avenue, were essentially the Indian trails that angled into the city from other places. So those streets are still there. So you see all this, everything's a grid, and then all of a sudden, another thing was going on is the Chicago River became a huge port. But the Chicago River, if you ever take one of these tours, it used to go toward the lake and then make a right turn and kind of limp out into the lake. So every ship coming in would have to make this big turn. So they said, no, we can't do that. We're going to have to make the thing straight. But the sand keeps moving around the lake. So they put a pier out there, and all of a sudden they just formed at the end of the pier. So they made the pier longer and longer and longer. But finally, it's way the hell out in the lake, like maybe a mile and a half. And all of a sudden the sand starts building up behind the pier. So this whole north side, I mean, you've been to Chicago, you ever heard of a place called Streeterville?
No, I haven't.
Well, it's, if you go up Michigan Avenue, going north and turn right, essentially you're in Streeterville. That whole area filled in with sand. But now it wasn't part of the city. It wasn't part of the grid. It just filled in. Nobody lived there. And all of a sudden, one guy comes in some boat, misses the river and lands in the sand, grounds the damn thing. Now, he's kind of a drunk. The boat's pretty big. He doesn't move it. And you can't boot him because the city doesn't really have the property, doesn't own the property. So, you know, it's navigation, right? What's the law for when you're on the water? Admiralty law? So the guy turns the place into a saloon and a whorehouse. And he was there like for years before they found a way to boot him, because they didn't have the jurisdiction. So that whole area became
Sure you had some interesting customers.
Oh yeah, so that whole area, that whole Streeterville was essentially a natural fill-in of, and those guys were all squatters for years and couldn't get them out. Hmm. And now it's, you know, high-end real estate. I mean, how the city finally did an exit, I don't know, but somehow they did.
Yeah.
So yeah, these stories are wild, aren't they? All right, you got to explain to us. We're on this other stuff that we love talking about. How does a country, you know, I mean, I don't even want to get into Venezuela story, because Kenny and I talked about it a little bit. How does a country like Iran, where 90% of the people want the guys out of there, or 85%, if you're not working for the government, I think you want them out of there. Their money supply is going up 30% a year, so their inflation's got to be to the moon. Even in the last 8 months, there's an article here from this is on the weekend by Ruxandra Yordash. Anyway, some lady wrote a nice article. Iran's currency briefly plunged to a record low against the dollar on the unofficial market after Tehran launched the missile and drone attack. The exchange rate is 705,000 reals to $1 in the open market at 10:30 a.m. on Sunday. So where was it? Exchange rate 705,000. It was the government set the official exchange rate in 2018. So 6 years ago, it was at 42,000. Now it's 705,000. Yeah. My question to you: How the hell do these guys do business and buy anything, let alone a drone or a missile or stuff? I know they're selling oil, but what are they getting for the oil? They must be getting dollars for the oil. I mean, you explain to me how the hell these guys could have anything to do anything with.
Well, I heard the Iranian Guard, you know, that vaunted Iranian Guard, Revolutionary Guard, it's like the defense complex. It'd be like the military industrial complex, I think, of the United States. That's the closest equivalent that we'd have of it. It accounts for like 70% of the economy. So I think people in Iran are just getting pummeled. And, you know, I think they're, you know, and I really think this war, it was made possible by Iran being able to sell its crude oil on the markets, right? I think during the 2018-19 era, they weren't really able to sell it, so they didn't have any revenues. And I think any revenue they get from that those sales, I think it goes right into their war making.
But how do you get them the money? They're not part of the SWIFT network, so they can't cash a check. I mean, what do you suppose the discount? Oil is $85. Of course, $85 means once you get the right grade to Cushing, Oklahoma, it doesn't mean if you're out in the middle of nowhere and I'm sitting here holding on a barrel of oil, it's worth $85. I got to get it someplace, right? What do you suppose the discount is?
I think, like, in any economy where, you know, government goes and bans something, makes it illegal, black markets form, right? And I'm sure that happens at the country level. So you have this valuable resource that Iran is producing. I'm sure they'd be able to find buyers of it that are in kind of black market.
So what kind of? I'm saying they're not going to get $80. So you've got a tanker that leaves an Iran port. The whole world, we got satellites. Everybody's got drones. They got everything. Everybody knows it comes from an Iran port. So it shows up at it hails port in India or someplace where they're willing to buy it, or Russian oil or something. What kind of discount are they getting? And they're getting paid in dollars? They must be.
They're probably getting a pretty good discount. And I would expect, you know, like you just said, you have satellites. I mean, we're observing these things. We're probably watching them going in and out of port. So there are government officials, like, watching this these illegal trades, if you will, these under-the-table trades at the national level. So, you know, the people that are probably buying it, the government probably knows who's buying it, right? I'm pretty sure it's pretty transparent to the government. It's not very transparent to us, but you have some very wealthy, rich people who are able to buy this crude oil, I suspect, at discounted prices. And I don't know if any of us could figure out what those are. When it comes to Iranian state data, I mean, it's pretty sketchy. Some years they don't release any data. And then all of a sudden, you know, 2018, 2019, that data just ends. I mean, so the data we get from Iran is questionable to begin with. So it's really hard to tell, but I'm sure there are some very wealthy people who are buying this oil, and they're buying it illegally, you know, according to international law, or in violation of, you know, sanctions, you know. And then they go out and sell it legitimately, right? So it happens at the individual level. It happened on Seinfeld. I was watching an episode of Seinfeld where they installed the low-flow showers. And what were Jerry and Newman and Kramer doing? They're on the black market looking for shower heads, right?
Oh, yeah. So
if it happens at the individual level, it happens at the country level.
Well, I think one of the key players here, and maybe not in a good way, is our alleged, and I'll use the term, half-assed ally in India. Because aren't they saying if they can get stuff at a discount, they're buying it? They've been buying Russian oil too, right? They're not willing to boycott the stuff because they need it.
Yeah, India, Brazil, and China and Russia and Iran are kind of like going off on their own. And, you know, to them, maybe it's legitimate. To us, it's illegitimate, right? I mean, we can't force our laws on a sovereign nation, so... If India wants to buy Iranian oil, that's their business, right?
They sure think so. But if they're asking us for aid for other stuff, money always comes with something, right?
Yeah, there's always strings attached, right?
Yeah.
But you know, our government is watching this stuff. I mean, you got to know, we have satellites trained on this stuff. We know where the oil's coming from, what port it's coming from. I mean, we know where it's going.
But if India wants,
like we're preventing it.
But I mean, if India wants, I mean, people will criticize every administration that's not theirs by saying they would always get a better deal. I don't know that if they're buying, you know, some high-end military stuff because they feel like they're threatened by China, that I don't say, well, if you want 20 F-15s, you can't be buying Russian oil, at least for a while. I mean,
I think that Iranian Revolutionary Guard that makes up 70% of the economy, I think they're probably building missiles and they're probably selling them, and you know, I think they're probably selling them to Russia. So I think they've got a lot of side hustles that we would consider illegal.
That's the thing. I know. Well, first of all, you're a guy who worked on a nuclear ship, so I'm not telling anything you don't know. These missiles. I mean, I worked at Pullman. A railroad car is nowhere near as complex as the ships you used to work on. But still, they were, what, 5,000 parts, 10,000 parts? You know, people go, Revolutionary Guard, I'm not saying you're doing this, Revolutionary Guard, they put together these missiles. Oh, wait a minute. You'd need a purchasing department of 40 people sourcing this stuff all over the world. How the hell do you get all those parts there unless you buy somebody's half-assed used missile someplace? And I can't imagine trying to assemble a missile of those many parts on stuff you're buying all over the world and all of it getting there in time to put the missile together. How do you do that?
From our perspective, we're not in this industry, but if you look at just the cartels, what the cartels does is illegal. And they're pretty sophisticated outfits, man.
So, well, they're obviously getting it from somewhere. Now, whether they're getting somebody else's used stuff or whatever,
CIA.
I guarantee you. Tom, if
Greg says CIA. Well, I mean, I think we probably know where some of it's coming from. I mean,
they know where it's coming from.
But like you mentioned earlier, the part about they're going to go to a black market guy and sell the oil, and then they're going to sell it. It may have happened. Maybe we are tough enough that we scare people off. But I'm going to say, I know some people in the marijuana business. If you go into some store and buy some hooch, they can trace the DNA of that hooch back to the plant at the place where they grew it. Okay, I'm going to say that there is many chemists in the world that if you pull up with Hal's Tanker in New Orleans or wherever the hell you're going with the thing, into a refinery, they can stick a bucket in there, pull out some oil, and within an hour tell you exactly where it came from. So
I'm pretty sure they can do that, yeah.
So
I agree.
Let's put it this way. We would have the capability of you're not going to get the Iranian tanker to go someplace, paint the thing, and send it to New Orleans. If we really wanted to, there's no way that gets here. When it gets here, right. I mean, now whether it's happening and we're looking the other way, who the hell knows? I mean, I don't know. I mean, I suppose if you asked, you know, Biden, he'd say, oh, no, we're not letting that happen, or Trump, that would never happen on my watch. I mean, whatever it is. Yet, do we really know? I don't think we do. Do we? They're getting money from somewhere, obviously.
We got to remember, you know, what we want. Other countries may not agree, right? I think India probably views its purchases from Iran as legitimate, or its sales to Iran as legitimate, right? This is a sovereign nation. But if you look at, I was going to mention something that I thought was really interesting. Like going back to cartels, if the United States all of a sudden banned guns, they're not going to destroy the demand for guns. The cartels probably have contingency plans put in place where they'll start making the guns that Americans want. And, you know, all that's illegal. They'll find ways to source the materials. They'll find ways. They'll create the logistics supply chains for it. And they'll create the logistics pushing the product into the United States. So, you know, the cartels are really, really, I guarantee their operations are as sophisticated as any on the planet. So if the cartels in Mexico can do this stuff,
I think you're right, and it's kind of an American point of view that if we ban guns, if the American point of view, and I sense it with you, but you know what, a lot of it's not necessarily true. Now, I mean, Australia decided after some gun violence, they don't want any guns. Nobody gets shot in Australia. I mean, Singapore, there's no guns there. God help you if you have a gun over there. I mean, there are places that actually enforce the law. I mean, you have the American point of view, which, by the way, I agree with you, unfortunately, that if we say Colt can't make the guns, somebody will find a way. But if every single time somebody has a gun, he's put away for 40 years, I'm not saying I want to do that, guess what? There wouldn't be any guns.
Yeah.
I mean,
I still think that, you know, government can't stop demand. People are going to demand it. And there's nothing really government can do about that.
I'm just saying, other governments do, though. Singapore, Australia, there's no guns in Britain.
Well, I'm sure people have guns in Britain.
Okay, but they're not nobody disclosed. I mean, there's more people got shot in Chicago this weekend than we shot in Britain all year in Australia.
Well, what I'm saying is the United States is really unique in the world in terms of, I think, of its gun rights. And I think, you know, European nations, they have this culture of the very wealthy, the property owners, the landlords, the nobles, they have certain rights that the regular people don't. And there's this long history of that. In the United States, we have this long cultural history of, well, the people at the bottom can become the people at the top. There's this churn, right? There's that history, that's that culture. And I don't think you can come in and just say, and Australia, I think, was a penal colony to begin with, right? So you had
the
prisoners.
Ago. Yeah.
Yeah. But that culture that is imbued in a society, that's a persistent thing, and it takes centuries to change that culture. So in Israel, when the Jews left Egypt, they needed 40 years, two generations to pass, because the older generations were institutionalized, like, you know, Brooks in Shawshank Redemption, they were institutionalized. And so they spent 40 years in the desert so that those older generations would die off, so they could start with a new culture, right? So I don't think that's going to happen in the United States. So what I'm saying is that culture takes forever to...
By the way, you're absolutely correct. It's not going to happen here. But the idea is we're powerless against it is total BS. I mean, if you were to take... and again, I'm not pounding on this one. I'm just you know, being good radio. But you feel like... By the way, I feel like you do too. It's not going to happen. But if you stop selling new guns... Okay, the police in Chicago confiscate what, 20,000 guns a year, 15?
Yeah,
you dry it up pretty quick.
Yeah,
I mean, without going door to door and searching people's closets, which nobody wants, you dry it up pretty quick.
Well, I don't think you'd want to go there because in Haiti, the only people that have guns
I didn't say I wanted to, but I'm saying the idea now that people are being shot in the middle of the day and everybody. That's not going to last at all. I mean, it can't last. Hell, no. I don't know.
Well, I don't honestly think it's the guns issue. I think it's the institutional racism that is inherent in these cities. Right? You have these kids who grew up in these impoverished households, broken homes with no father figure.
I get it.
They go to a public school and they have no marketable skills because they graduated from a public school where they can't read and can't do math. I think it was 75% of crime is committed by high school dropouts.
I'm nobody feels more like you do on that subject than me, except I don't care what happened to you along the way. You can't open fire on a bunch of people, or
I'm not advocating for that at all.
I mean,
the gun issue is a symptom of a cancer.
I get it.
But we always go after the symptoms, not the cancer.
There reaches a point. I don't know how we got on the subject, but I'm going to say I've read, you know, quite a bit about, nowhere near enough to be an expert, but a lot of the history of, like, Adolf Hitler. Okay, guy had a horrendous childhood. Parents didn't like him. Nobody loved him. Kicked out, whatever he was. He was on the streets of Vienna. Nobody liked him there. Everybody beat the crap out of him whenever they could. He was a little guy. Then he joined the army, and nobody liked him because he was an ugly little dude. And all of a sudden, the guy had this horrendous life, okay? Which, if he could go back and change, he'd probably like to change, okay? But all of a sudden, he becomes this mass murderer. At that point, I don't care about his childhood. I mean, I care about it, but I got to stop him. I can't let him hurt anybody else. I mean, it reaches a point where, you're right, these kids come from the bad families, they run around a car at night, can't wait to shoot somebody. I got to stop him because the other person has some rights too. The shootee has more rights than the shooter, in my mind.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these cities, I mean, they don't protect people's property. They protect the rich person's property. They don't protect people's property rights. The Rite Aid, there's a Rite Aid in Brooklyn that closed down, and it's probably because the owner's property rights were not being protected by the city. People go in, they shoplift a bunch of goods, they're not prosecuted because it's under some dollar value, they're let loose. So the key here is, you know, one of government's duties is to protect people's property. and it's just not doing it.
Try it first. Protect you.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, yourself is your property. Your body is your
property.
Well,
I'm saying, if there are legitimate families in Inglewood, what are their kids? What do you think their kids are like walking to the bus to go to school down Ed Block?
Yeah. The government is not protecting their property. They're not protecting these people's bodies. They're not protecting their goods on the shelves, and that's what one of the problems with Gaza. Property rights are not protected in Gaza. The people that run Gaza before October 7th. They weren't protecting people's property rights. And there was 50% unemployment in Gaza, right? And that's exactly what Hamas wanted.
What do you suppose it is in Iran? Do we have any kind of a read?
Well, I was looking at the employment rate in Iran, and the employment rates are really quite low, hovering 35%. Labor force participation was, compared to the United States, really low. Their unemployment rate for adults is about 10%, but the unemployment rate for 18 to 25 year olds is 25%. So there's labor market problems in Iran, and I'm surprised that the Iranian government can hang on to power there. But that's the problem with one party rule.
Well, everybody. How many people do you know from Iran? I know probably 8 to 10.
I had a student who was Persian, and he was in my MBA class, and I was talking about 300 and Xerxes, who's Persian, right in the movie, and I was like, I was parodying. Xerxes saying I'm a kind god, right? And that I'm not going to have an exam, right? And he mentioned he is from Iran, and he has an interesting perspective, and he's here because of the tyranny.
Well, if you have any skill set, like I know one of the guys is an engineer. He said if I went there, I'd never get back out.
Yeah,
I mean it's everybody I know here has at least one advanced degree, and. They said it's horrible over there, but these guys, somehow they hang in. Hal, thank you very much, buddy. By the way, enjoy yourself out in Columbia, Missouri. Don't be running around in any meth labs out there. So be careful.
I'm not gonna do that.
We'll be back tomorrow. Stocks and Jocks. S&P futures up 8. NASDAQ futures up 17. We're trying to stay up here. We'll see if we do.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit hamzyanalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. Dax Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.